No Directions PaizoCon 2019 seminar coverage is brought to you by our patrons at patreon.com/NoDirection.
Sure,
let's start.
If you are here for the Fantastical Set Dressing panel, you are in the right place. Congratulations. So, I'm Judy Bauer. I'm the managing editor of Paizo.
I'm Leo Glass. I'm an editor at Paizo.
And I'm Jason Tondra. I'm also an editor.
We are Legion.
We are Legion.
Yeah.
Welcome. We're sort of brainstorming what we thought would be valuable to you all one day, and we sort of realized that, hey, setting and set dressing and the ways that we portray scenes and sort of help immerse not only our players but our readers as writers was something that could be really important. So we hope that this will be interactive and not just us talking, because while we think we have some things that we can share, we definitely want your participation as well, and definitely if you've got something you really want to talk about, we can do that too. Our sort of starting point is we are editors. You heard us all say that, so you're going to kind of hear that as sort of the point of view. But we're all also writers, so we're all also GMs. So that's sort of allows us to wear different hats, and we wear a lot of different hats as editors. So while some of it may be sort of skewed in that direction, don't feel afraid to help us look at it from other angles. So we wanted to start with this simple question, and we'll just kind of start with Judy and Jason, and I'll chime in wherever. Why is setting and set dressing important?
Maybe I wanted to start off a little bit by sort of going off of something Leo was already touching on, which is the idea that, you know, when we were sort of brainstorming this panel, figuring out kind of what to do with it, it's built as a workshop, and we're all editors, so we decided to sort of think of all of you as like potential writers for Paizo. Like any one of you could come across our desk with a OP adventure or an alien archive entry or a back matter article or something. So we decided to kind of aim it that way. There's a lot of ways that overlaps with stuff like at your own personal gaming table. Those are related things, but like a Venn diagram, they're not completely overlapping. Maybe we'll have a chance to talk about some more of that in the Q&A session, you know, if stuff about your sort of personal table situations. But from a writing standpoint, I think it's really, really easy when you're constructing sets and settings in your work to kind of fall back on well-worn cliches and stereotypes. And you have no idea how many articles, how many words we see come across our desk at the editor panels. I mean, in the editor pool. And when we read adventures or we read, you know, Backmire articles or whatever, the articles that stand out are the ones that are really kind of the people put extra time and extra effort into. And that can be hard when we're all so busy and so time crunched all the time. Right, it can be really hard to find time. So, to try to get back to answering Lou's question, to make that setting and that set dressing stuff really stand out, we have to reach for the un-cliche, the non-cliche, right? The stuff that hasn't been done a million times before, and sometimes that well-tread stuff can be a great place to start. But I think maybe the better way to go is to try to find the time to put in well-placed time, and not ask anybody to waste their time, but to do it in a concentrated and interesting and focused way to try to bring particular set pieces out from one scene to the next. You don't have to do this all the time everywhere. No one's asking for perfection all the time. But if you can bring out a few really cool settings in your story or your adventure or your article, it can really bring that thing to life for your reader and make it stand out and not just be another 8 pages that I have read.
Yeah, and kind of for perspective, so we see like 6 adventures a month. So it's really constant. And it's tricky to have things kind of not... how do you make all the castles not be kind of the same castle? And it's also, right. There's kind of, you know, like... So part of it, I think, you know, one thing that I'm trying to, you know, like, that I look at and are hoping to make us avoid is making sure that, like, so one, castles are not all the same, but also if you have buildings in different, like, places that have very different climates, very different cultures, very different backgrounds, right, that they aren't the same. So, like, if you have, like, that heavily fortified stone citadel somewhere might make sense in, like, an Ulfin kingdom or something. But if you're in, you know, like, the floating islands or the floating archipelago, you're probably going to want something with a little more airflow or everybody is going to bake to death. If you, you know, if you have a Starfinder setting location, you want it not to seem like maybe some off, like, very modern day office cubicles. And that's really the main challenge we have with Starfinder, is things too on the nose modern day. And we're like, well, is this actually the layout of our office? Oh. Why am I at work even in my adventures? So just trying to bring in, like, a little more kind of uniqueness and kind of set, really looking at for details of the setting partly details of the setting that you can expand on to make things a little more kind of playful and surprising, but also things that kind of break out of, like, a Western European mold. So.
Setting can bring a real sense of wonder to your story and to your players. And I'm thinking, Judy, your comment made me think of the Starfinder section, where all the different starships from all the different factions are lined up. And they're so interestingly different from one another. Like, you would never confuse one of those Necrogliders, right?
Right, with, like, a Xenowarden.
For a starfighter from a different faction.
Yep. Yeah,
and I love the detail that it's like, oh, by the way, no atmosphere, because dead.
And the pilot doesn't even get to move. He's just, like, strapped into the Necroglider like this.
Right.
Right, and he steers the whole thing with his brain, so it's like a flying crypt. And I'm like, how cool is that? Right?
So how does someone get to that, right? So, like, so I want to ride a ship, and I want to ride a undead ship, and I get really excited, and I sit down, and then I'm riding my cubicle, because that's what I know, right? So how, I guess it was just a good segue, how would you all approach that problem? How would you dress that set? What are ways in which?
What set are we dressing?
An undead ship.
An undead ship.
I'm just a fan of getting back to first principles, right? Like,
sure.
Nothing that says an undead ship has to be like anything else. So what do you need? You got to have somebody to fly the ship, right? What are the first principles? They're undead. They don't need oxygen, right? They don't need oxygen.
Sure.
Right? So if you strip away everything that absolutely doesn't have to be there, that all becomes white space for doing something different.
And now our challenge is, but how do we make an undead ship that's not like the ones we already have?
Sure. Yeah.
Right?
You can also, if it's an undead ship, then everyone on it is going to be old. You know, because they're going to be dead for probably a long time if they're undead.
Right.
So maybe the equipment is, like, of an age.
So this also gives you an opportunity of showing off elements of your backstory to your setting, right? Like, you can include everything from mundane objects like silverware and dishes to weapons and armor that evoke previous eras of the setting that the players don't really know a lot about.
What does an undead ship even need to have anything in the realm of day-to-day life, if they have no use for that, unless you're using a culture that's heavy into funerary rites, there's really no reason for them to carry anything of their past lives over, especially if there's some sort of flaw.
How
do you power it? Are you taking the fresher undead and sticking them in until they're old?
You say that, and I have to say, the other day I had to ask the question of, do the Dijin use toilets? Because I had a genie ship, and I had all these bathrooms that looked like, and I went, how does that work? Like, what? And does it look so much like our urinals? Like, for example, would it?
Such a detailed map.
Yeah.
It's for sand.
But anyway, yeah. Sorry, you made me think of that.
Really, even going back to the first principles, what is it for?
Right.
Like,
right.
Well, if you're having a ship, what is the purpose of the ship?
Yep.
Are you bringing things from point A to point B?
Is there a freighter?
Are you bringing things? Are you bringing undead creations? What is the purpose? Is it purely to fight? If you don't know what the purpose is, you can't really design.
Well, but your point is that once you do figure out the purpose, that helps get you farther along.
And then also the person to operate, do you really even need that? I mean, it's an undead ship. The power is the ship undead, or is it a ship for undead?
Right, right. Where's the adjective in that sentence?
Sure. Yeah.
Also, kind of going off of that, thinking about what kind of spaces you would need in your adventure,
yep.
And then thinking, like, why would that space exist in this ship, castle, whatever, and, like, making sure that it makes sense and works for what you need it to do.
This is a great point, I think, because you don't have to, a lot of you guys are sort of going back to, like, well, let's design the thing first, but you can also do it from the opposite, which is, what's the cool scene I want to happen on this undead ship? And now, because we're all pretty creative people, what's the reason why that thing that I need is there? Right? So if I want to have a big sword fight on the deck of my undead space galleon, now I got to think, well, then that means that there must be crew there for them to sword fight with. Now I have to think of why do they have crew and what do they use them for? Right? And so on. If I want to make sure that I've got a big navigating, ship wheel on it. Well, now I have to think of, well, why do they need wheels, right? And so all of that becomes not necessarily. You can do that from the outside going in, but you're going to do it from the inside going out.
So just taking what we've heard, right? Good set dressing then sort of builds from simple, strong first principles. It fills some sort of space or occupies something that maybe it's a need, maybe it's a want, maybe it's just a direction or a goal. And it also serves a purpose. That's what y'all came up with. And I think we all agreed with that because you pretty much just did our outline for us. So that tells us something a little bit about setting too, right? That we can kind of, we all sort of know what it takes to build that setting. But we don't always get there, right? As we've kind of talked about. So what are the challenges that we face? And feel free, y'all, what are the barriers to that? Yeah.
In either first or type character person is details that the point of view character isn't going to notice either because they're so mundane and normal to them that it wouldn't be pointed out. Like someone from the modern developed world isn't going to point out the windows have glass in them, even though this would be impressive to someone from the Middle Ages or the ancient world.
Sure.
Or it's something they don't care about, like the person is, pretty much oblivious to clothes unless they're drastically out of place.
Right.
So I can't really use them for much fashion world building.
Well, it's interesting because I'm going to go old school for a minute. You'd be surprised how many authors don't give you the details that you think that they do. I'm in the middle of my reread of Lord of the Rings, which I do every couple of years, right? And he never tells you what color Legolas' hair is. We're all convinced Legolas is blonde. We don't know. How do you get that, right? We get it because Orlando Bloom is blonde, right? But he never tells you what the people are wearing, what their clothes look like. He never tells you any of that stuff. People walk into buildings. They walk through houses. What do those things look like? He never tells you, right? Mm-hmm. So, and I just use that as one example. Like, so you feel like adding these details wouldn't be appropriate for what your characters would do. Mm-hmm. I think you can get away with that. It's kind of obviating what our panel is talking about, but but I think, on the other hand, you can add the things that the characters would pay attention to.
So,
right?
For example, like turns out there was a time in Siberia where like windows are a thing.
Yes,
glass is really expensive and transportation is hard. People used in the winter. People used ice, like big chunks of ice, to fill in their windows. Which I think tells you a little bit about how cold it still was inside. But But you have your light. There's no wind. It's not probably 50 below because you have hopefully you're burning something. But all the light, then you can imagine, would have this kind of a little bit of that like blue green kind of. So it's like, I think you can add in the details that would be kind of a mundane thing, give it a spin like that, and then just see, okay, like how does that affect the mood of kind of what your setting is?
Yeah. Going back, or kind of like looking at the whole thing as a whole, does that mean that going over those mundane details, like stressing them, or even just kind of like describing the whole scene, does that mean that could be too much?
Yeah.
It's like you guys just like, because you guys got to do with word crunch. And
I can hear one of the devs on our team right now talking about Chekhov's gun a little bit, because there are details,
And those are good, and we call it set dressing, right? We're talking about,
yeah.
But if there's no, I think your point had it, if it doesn't fill a space, like I think of it like, all right, I've got these details, I've got this ornate window, I want it to shatter, I want it to do something, I want it to, and Crystal Frazier, sorry, I always attribute to Crystal, it's Ron. Ron Lundeen wrote, it's one of the 140s, this great painting that serves like seven different roles in that adventure. It ends up being a talking NPC. It ends up being basically a puzzle solver. It ends up being just a really interesting painting to interact with and look at. It's the first thing you see, yes, in Dead Roads when you come in. And it's honestly one of the best set pieces I think I've read in an adventure because not only is it really cool and it's a great detail and it's well described, but it serves so many purposes to the actual adventure that propel the story forward. Move, and we are writing for games, right? So we have to move players.
And your observation about word count is absolutely right. Like, I cannot stress that enough. Like, we have really tight word restrictions. Now, at the same time, you'll often find after when you're pretty late in the process, you end up with a couple of extra sentences room here and there. And if you're the writer, you can just go in and add that, like if you're doing this on your own. But if you're giving it to us or giving it to a publisher, you're not going to be able to do all that. You're going to have to leave it for the developers or, you know, to do. But yeah, word count is really tight. And so a little of this set dressing, I think, goes a long way. It's much better to have a really important single set piece, you know, the magic statue in your foyer or whatever, that's doing a bunch of work than trying to just fill the whole thing with cool sets. Because a lot of that just kind of, you know, you're players' eyes are going to glaze over, right? And they're going to walk through it.
And especially if you have kind of a few connecting notes that you can get, you can just sprinkle a few details here and there and just like slowly build kind of the sense, like as, because you don't have to put everything in one place and blow your whole word count in once. Like, or if you want to have one central thing, then you say, well, okay, like every room gets like two or three, like maybe two interesting details that are just like, oh,
by the way. And that's a really good point, too, that there's kind of two different things we're talking about, right? There's the huge, big, cool set piece that's carrying a lot of weight.
Sure.
And then there's just, like, half a sentence. And literally, that can be all it takes is half a sentence to make a room not just be another wandering dungeon room, right? Do you guys all remember Aliens?
Like, yes. Okay.
In the, we meet the Marines in Aliens. Do you remember? We meet, like, 12 Marines in about 2 minutes. And they each get like half a sentence. But in that half a sentence, you know everything you need to know about them. Right? It's just wonderful characterization of economy. Now, take that from characters to sets and try and do the same thing. And of course, you know, Cameron's a genius, right? So we're not going to be able to do quite that good. But aspiration.
Yeah.
And it is worth, there's two things there worth noting. And the first one is something that you just talked about. You can build everything you want on your own. Like, if you want to make a castle and you want to pick each individual rock that the masons laid to make this castle, you're welcome to do that. Your players aren't going to care, you know. So the make something in the rest of the castle cool, give it one sentence, and you know exactly how deep into the details you've gotten in case it ever comes up. Somebody was talking about that with Wayne Reynolds' art earlier.
Sure.
When Hicks in the armor, he has a story for all of them, but he doesn't, you know, write out paragraphs of it for you. You know, you can go ask him. And the second thing is, you know, back to that necroglider, sometimes you can just make a detail because it looks awesome, right? Like, he's got his arms crossed like it's a crypt because it's awesome.
Right. He doesn't, this is going back to your point, right? He doesn't need to be like that. He's that way because we want him to be like that, and then we just think of a reason.
Luis Loza once said to me when I was asking him, why do we do this with this particular item? He's like, because it's rad. Come on. And I was like, well, then let's make, and I mean, and sometimes we'll do that too, where I messaged Keely the other day and said, hey, I think this is really cool. Can we turn this up?
Yeah.
You know, and so you find those little details. What are you going to say?
Well, so what's really the fine line then, like, between too enough and not enough, all right, and too much? Because, like, what, me as a GM, I end up, like, an adventure path book, for the most part, isn't off the shelf, I can just run it.
Right,
I need
right.
to go in and hours of prep.
Yes.
Which I absolutely enjoy because I still have to put in the move.
Yeah.
I've got to describe, like,
right.
well, if I'm playing a horror campaign, I want to put in, like, What does it smell like?
Yeah.
Putting in those details that I don't necessarily fit. But
preparation itself becomes the game to some extent. I mean, you enjoy doing it, right? Yeah. But go on.
But it's like, what is too much? Like, then do you want to put in the details if you're the writer saying this is the mood I want to convey?
Right.
Like, and how do you put that in? Because like, I love horror campaigns, but it's like, okay, well, a lot of them fall short of the, what, like, it's dark and gloomy.
Yes. You can only do dark and gloomy so often,
exactly.
Right? And it loses all of its value. Think about what we were just saying, like, how you have kind of, like, two different kinds of setting, right? Are you doing, like, an important key set piece that you want the players to interact with, that you want them to pick up and try and find the knobs and push it and pull it and do all that. Or is it relatively casual settings establishing a mood, but you're not really trying to get the players to interact with it? So if it's the former, you're going to put a lot of time and energy onto developing that thing. But if it's the latter, you can give it half a sentence and move on. But watch out for your repetition, because you're absolutely right. It's a huge issue.
Writing-wise, I use my outlines for this, and I'm still learning and trying to figure it out, but I will say that if I've got an outline that's got a chunk like this, that and there are little pieces that are here and here, that says to me, this needs minimal, concise, or maybe sometimes this needs to be tightened up so that they're but like you want to look at, I think, your skeleton underneath sometimes, too, and say, okay, what deserves the most time, you know?
How would you keep players from fixating on like things that you wrote for set dressing that aren't necessarily
the red herring issue?
Oh man.
Well, I mean, sometimes the answer is just go for it. Like if the players really decide, like, oh my gosh, this thing, this is clearly a time machine. We're doing it. We're going.
Yes.
Sure. That's 5 minutes. Sure. Yeah. Okay. Okay, totally will grant that orc play, for example, you can't have random time machines, probably, I guess.
Wet blanket. But yeah, you're okay, so every developer will tell you, you can never predict what the players are going to think is cool. You can try to make that cool bad guy or that cool NPC or whatever, and the players are going to think it's a yawner. And someone's going to get totally fixated on that random street urchin that you threw in because you were stalling for time, right? And you just can't predict it. Yeah. I know that street urchin. They've shown up in my game too. So this is the difference between at your table and when you're writing a manuscript, right?
I was just going to say, I guess too, like if you're writing them all and running. Try not to make the red herring cooler than the actual thing. And I guess also, like, in terms of, like, weight and, like, when you're giving hints and stuff, like, make sure that, like, additional pointers that you're putting in to, like, give people clues or be like, oh, all these corners have, why do all these rooms have so many corners? Or, you know, like, things, like, all your weird, creepy clues are, like, not all, you know, most of them are, that they don't double also for the red herring. So you're all eventually pointing at this.
And if that red herring's not filling a space, I'm going to get rid of it. I mean, like, maybe in editing, maybe, you know what I mean? Like, if it's not really doing something and it's not cool, then I'm going, these words could probably go to some rules or something, too, so.
And some of the last points that we've touched on have come up in games that I've run in organized play. I just ran like
good.
Pathfinder,
yeah.
Where... you know, you had a horror setting. It was a modified version of the Phantasmal Killer. So some season 10 scenario had a lot of work. The players ended up becoming Celestial Werewolves for the scenario.
Yes!
It's a cool scenario. But you end up in a haunt in this haunted mist, and it casts a modified version of Phantasmal Killer,
okay.
Where if you fail both saves, you're only taking a bunch of negative energy damage instead of outright dying.
Okay.
It's a scenario.
Yeah.
That would be but it, you know, it kind of just prods the GM with a blurb of like, okay, the players are to describe their character's worst fear, and you narrate it, you know, and like you said, half a sentence, right? Like now I can, when they describe it, I can say, oh, it smells like this, it feels like this, your skin's rotting off and falling off your hands, right? All that kind of stuff.
Right.
Like, anything like that, you're being very alive, describe that in as much detail as you want, you know?
That's a tough moment, though, because you need the players to help you with that.
Yeah, and right. that's ad-lib skills, and it's finding where your players yeah. are comfortable, but the scenario gives you enough to know what you
Good.
Need to do
Good.
In the writing itself in a small word count.
Yeah.
And then sometimes you get a red herring. There was a Starfinder scenario. They're trying to figure out what's killing miners on this planet. There's security forces. There's a secret group of Sarcesians. And the players are fixated on the security forces because they all have guns.
Yes.
You know? And so at that point, you just have to start pulling things out. When the player's rolling professional soldier, yep. whatever you say, like, you're familiar with this, you know, security company. They're not known to kill their clients. You know, start walling them off with clues
That's right.
every time they ask a question.
This is a good point, because I think maybe by calling it a red herring, I was actually doing an injustice, because a red herring is something you put in on purpose. But your question was about stuff that you don't intend the players, right? It's just kind of an accident. Like, you can't predict... This is the difference between role-playing and computer games, right? Like, the fact that players can go wherever they want to is kind of the beauty of the hobby. So, I know this is hard for us sometimes, but try to embrace it, right?
Yeah.
If the players want to run off and, you know, screw that dragon,
I mean,
we want to run a long con on the innkeeper, you know? Okay!
I'm running a game tomorrow where I have the setup written, and that's all I'm going to write. I'm just gonna let the players take us wherever we go, and I mean, you gotta, if you're comfortable with that, you can do it. You know, I'm not, but I think that there's multiple ways. Now, obviously, if I submit a quarter of a scenario to a dev, and say, well, the GM will just figure it out, that's probably not so great.
This is where those Venn diagrams do not overlap.
Yeah, yeah. Right?
When you're writing an adventure or you're writing an article for publication, you've got to write all that stuff. But as you noted, always remember that the GM is going to take what you've written and they're going to change it. They're going to muck it up. They're going to do their own thing with it. Don't be too attached to it. Do the best you can with it. But you're not even going to see everything you write in print. I mean, it's going to go through a developer first, then it goes through editors, and it goes through design passes. I mean, lots of hands. We may just have to cut two sentences from this thing because the art's too big. Like, this is just the way it works, you know? So
those pole arms, man, they're really
yeah.
And I guess, well, another, maybe a more OP-friendly response to that, too,
yeah.
is... try to make the red herring that they get attached to, like, actually point back to the plot. Like, oh, they see something that was just kind of, like, evocative set dressing, but not actually load-bearing, and they're like, oh my goodness, this is a secret map to everything. And you're like, maybe not, but it probably had this symbol. When you're thinking back and looking at your sketch, you notice there was this symbol of that evil deity who's maybe actually, come on, guys, the temple. So you can kind of...
Yeah.
Try to tie even the little bits of red herrings that
Look
players
at the
get attached to.
Distracted by the smell of brimstone because the demon is
right. And you know, I don't know, but I have a theory a little bit that kind of comes from kind of what we're going to sort of talk about, though, of just like the crypts all being the same. Or, like, I don't know, but I feel like if I'm always put in the same kind of room as a player, I want to figure out why I'm in that room. And I'm going to scratch at the walls to try to find the chocolate pudding underneath. And the GM's like, there's no chocolate pudding. And I'm like, no, I can't stand the grayness. And so if you did something that, you know, as far as the set dressing goes, right? Like, then you play. And I mean, again, maybe my group's weird, but I see that to where it's like, if I gave them Ron's painting, they're just going to hone in on Ron's painting.
Yeah.
But if I give them a bland room, they're going to try to figure out if the doorknob comes off the door and there's a magical portal to Narnia or something.
Give them something to interact with so that they don't get distracted. That's a great lesson.
Yeah.
So where's the line between putting in accuracy and research into a historical or location-based setting based on real life? And what's the line between that and putting in unreasonable amounts of research and wasting your time on small details?
Meet your deadlines.
True.
I mean, I think, like, we're, you know, go for broad brush strokes, right? Like, we don't have to know exactly, like, if I'm building a castle or, you know, like a fort in Jal Marais, I don't need to know how the plumbing worked, but I do need to know that, like, oh, there was, like, a one, like, bathroom for every, like, 15 people was, I think, like, how a bunch of, like, historic forts were built in India. Also, interior walls tended in, like, if it was in a warmer climate, tended to be not always solid and just... in forts, more solid, but, like, in palaces were, like, more, like, porous and even lacy to let the wind through and all, you know, like, so look for some evocative details and then just kind of, like, have that as, because you really just need people to get, you need people to get the flavor of it rather than, you know, like, they're not, unless they really decide, if they decide they want to build their own Nargar Hill Fort, then you can, like, have that, like, recruit them to help do the research to, like, find out all the details of what you know, are trying to do. But if you're just going to be there for, like, one session of a game, then, like...
You know, an area where I want to see more historical accuracy is with the descriptions of settings that involve indigenous peoples. Mm. And just embracing that diversity and letting that be what it is. If I see another goblin with a chieftain headdress, I might scream a little bit. Because some, and the word tribe and just those things that, you know, it's like, wait a minute, do you really know what you're writing about? Have you really taken the time to do some research? And I hope I don't offend anyone, but I do think it's a good, I've used those words myself, so I'm not, but I think just thinking about, okay, what are the barriers and boxes I have when I sit down to write? What am I mean, I think you can take that into lots of realms of inclusivity, but I think that there are devs on our team who, if they saw that depicted, would be like, yes, let's hire them some more. Let's keep that going. So,
the both of these are really great points. And I think this idea of the potential for set dressing to make your setting more inclusive and to show that there's more to the universe than traditional role-playing tropes is a fantastic opportunity and often, I think, maybe often overlooked. But to get back to your research question, like, can we all acknowledge that research is like a never-ending rabbit hole? And it's so fun. Like, I just get into it. And it, because it's so much easier now than it used to be. You know, I'm like old man Tondra, right? So I remember when you had to look up actual physical books, right?
Microfiche.
Yeah. But now, like, the universe is on my phone, right? So yeah, like
you can still find microfiche on your phone.
Don't tempt me, okay? So
I tend to also think is look at the things that are likely to that your players are likely to directly interact with. Like if you have a fighter or barbarian who likes to try to kick down doors and bust through walls, look at interior construction.
Like, yeah,
sure. It tends to be less solid. So your fighter goes up to rev against the, you know, Japanese paper sliding screen. It has a spectacular pratfall. Or, like, if your rogue cannot stay out of locked doors, like something might be expensive. Even if your players aren't really into food porn, the fact that they're rummaging around the medieval locked cabinets and find a bunch of cardamom.
Yeah. I think a fighter who's so used to knocking down doors that he's become an expert on interior door design.
I'm just laughing as you said that because Judy's my boss, right? But when I ran a game for her as a goblin, she was the most rummaging, how can I get all the gold?
Are you an Elder Scrolls veteran? Yeah, like, so wanna, like, pillage
it's just
every
funny
cabin?
How people wear different hats. Anyway.
So something that's always bugged me, and I want to ask how you guys would. Yes, yeah, so something that's always bugged me is that we play these games in worlds of danger and intrigue, right?
Yeah.
Where we have a not uncommon amount of intelligent flying monsters mm-hmm. or unintelligent flying monsters, mm-hmm. and yet we continually build our game cities and our game towns as though they are Renaissance Italy, where no such things ever existed, and we don't have any spiky things sticking out of the tops of our buildings. We don't have closely knit small communities that are, instead of being spread out over the entire hillside, are close together so that when the goblins come over the hills, it's easier to get all the children behind the walls.
How can we still as set dressers?
Dead.
What's that?
We still bury our dead.
We still bury our dead. Right. Why? We have necromancers out there. You know, like,
why would you do
it's
that?
Hard, it's hard to raise a family. Not if they're buried close enough together.
Yeah, you remind me of that great line from Star Trek 2, right? We're still exhibiting a lot of two-dimensional thinking.
We are still exhibiting a lot of two-dimensional. How do you, as set dressers, like, you're the people that are giving us the popular games that we love,
yeah,
right? So how can we tip these apple carts of design and make and start thinking like people that live in worlds full of monsters?
Well, and this is a really hard one, actually, for us, for, like, the simple reason that of maps, right? Like, maps get ordered real pretty early in the process, and once you have a map of your village, that's it. So
there's
that's
very little
change
really
that can
be made
to rely.
Once the map's been made.
Yeah,
so
we have to really rely on.
From step one, tell the map maker, by the way, you know, we need you to not think inside this box.
Well,
we need you to think about someone that lives.
But
in
that comes back to that purpose piece. That comes back to those spaces
right.
piece. Like,
what you're talking about is idea of verisimilitude versus this kind of deduction. A process where, on the one hand,
I firmly blame TSR for all of this. By the way,
well, you're thinking, well, our fantasy worlds don't make sense, but
kind of
the players also expect a certain amount of familiarity when they get there. If we build our cities so that they're all designed to resist flying assault. Your example was like spiky towers and all kinds of, mm-hmm. you know, put a dome over it or something. We can do that, but it becomes less familiar to players. Now, for some groups, unfamiliarity is good. But when you're making a fantasy setting for 60 million Americans, familiarity belongs in the setting a little bit more, right? So all I'm trying to get at is just note the challenge.
I would contend, having had this conversation with other designers.
Sure, and I'm not trying to argue.
I would contend that as the people who are creating the world,
yeah.
it is our job,
yeah. right?
Right, collective hour,
yep.
to say, well, it's a fantasy world, so
yeah.
familiarity doesn't enter into it. If you're capable of accepting dragons, if you're capable of accepting that
sure.
Bob the Necromancer
sure.
has raised his family for
yeah.
the fourth time this week,
yeah.
Then we can accept
a
little difference in our construction.
Yeah, I don't think that it's a believability issue.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a player assumption issue. Because they walk into a city and they want to be able to do X thing.
Well,
like,
yeah.
I think this becomes an issue more of setting design than adventure design.
Yeah.
That, right? That's the big picture that sort of frames all these things.
But it still sets.
Yeah. So I think if you're setting that way, then you've got a lot more leeway for that.
Have you all read The Design of Everyday Things?
Yeah, Donald Norman.
Yeah, that's a fantastic book that can directly apply to what we're talking about here. Because it's just like, why does the door open
right.
that way?
Right.
And the door shouldn't open
what's
that way.
The name
why?
Of the door? What's the name of that particular door that he hates?
The Norman door.
Yeah.
It's also a, you know, you could design all of your cities to protect against flying monsters, but, you know, does your average village have, you know, architects that are capable of building 15-foot-long palisades on the roof of every building?
And maybe that's,
you know, you're working with peasants, you know?
From
how common are the dragons?
You know, honestly, this comes back to kind of one of our earlier points. To me, how I would do it is I would think, what do I want the setting to look like? And then I think of a cool reason for the setting I already want. Right, is how I would do it, but your idea of the setting that you're talking about would look a lot different than Galarian would or Greyhawk would.
I don't know. Galarian still has a lot of common flying monsters.
No. What I'm saying is that it would, but it wouldn't physically. It would have a lot of differences from Galarian, right? Because it has all those flying monsters, but it doesn't have. But you would have a different architecture style.
I think of Glenn Cook, though, right, in the Black Company novels. And I think of, like, bringing it down, bringing high fantasy down to, like, a Vietnam epic sort of, like, I can just set up pickets and a, you know, sharpened sticks in front of a line, and nobody's getting through that. Like, all I have to do is hack the wizard in the face before he can speak, and it's over. Like, so what? You can move mountains. I have a sword. Like, and so I think there is a space. I just want to. There is a space for that
thinking. And I mean, I love those.
Yeah, and my
like I lit up when you started saying that because I was like, yeah, impale all the demons on the, you know, like let's build really awesome castles that because I think that there is a niche.
Yeah, my end point was actually to encourage that because my point was that that creates a really interesting opportunity for us a setting that stands out from other ones. That it creates a, you know, like, hey, this is the place where we've taken the physics of magic in fantasy gaming and tried to extrapolate what the world looks like with those magical rules.
Right. I mean, the reason we built city walls is because there were marauding wolves and bears, right?
Right.
I mean, you know, bears are terror monsters.
Right, sure. So
we don't need flying things, but we build city walls in reality because of bears.
You don't have to convince the editorial department of the frightfulness of bears.
Yeah.
I think there were... I love that that's a quote. I think there were some other hands up, though. Yeah. Go ahead.
I was just going to say, maybe if you had something going on in the Lands of the Lenorm Kings, because you've got dragons...
Yep.
That they could be a little bit more spiky. Okay, you got the Viking Hall and the horns and the rams. And what is that on the roof? But the other thing, if you had to just get it specific so that it kind of swelled into everything else, maybe you've got like this cavalier order that does nothing but go after dragons and things. And their buildings are all porcupines with windows and doors.
And this becomes a great way where your setting becomes a cool bit about that character faction, for example. And it starts telling a story, which is neat.
And I think this becomes really a big factor, too, is just we've got such a variety of threats now. There is no architecture that protects you.
Right? Yeah.
Protect from the dragons, the earth elementals kill you from the water, right? Like, I mean, there's just stuff that will deal with any problem, so you kind of got to pick and choose. And I think as a designer for a setting, you got to decide what's the norm, right? Maybe you don't have a lot of dragon problems here, right?
You know, and
maybe you do.
Let's be frank. If you could build architecture that stopped all the menaces, where would the adventurers be? Like, we have to... The city has to have problems because the heroes need XP.
And I want to run an architectural campaign now, though.
Yeah.
Like, at that point, the adventures take place between the cities like you have in Dark Sun.
Right.
So...
Yeah. Well, I suppose it's not too different from on Earth, where architecture's, you know, generally a compromise between the available local materials and what kind of hazards are the most likely. Like around here, we have to worry about earthquakes, but hurricanes and extreme heat or cold aren't currently much of an issue. Or, you know, in California, you have to worry about droughts and flood and wildfires as well as earthquakes.
Right.
In the Midwest, you need to worry more about extreme weather and tornadoes.
Tornadoes, yeah.
So, you know, like, each place has its own terrifying megafauna and its own perfect senses.
Yeah.
Just like, you know, in different parts of the world with weather hazards.
So we kind of started doing it. We were going to move into, you know, what are some settings we see, and we were going to kind of talk about ways to improve them, and we kind of started doing it already, so... are there any other, so I think that's a really interesting example of like, how do we build on are there any others or did you want to add something?
Actually, I wanted to go back to something that you touched on. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name. I have a terrible name.
No, it's Judy.
Judy. And I wanted to go back to something you touched on, which was environment and whatnot, you know, as to how cultures develop sets and architecture, but what about religion? So, for example, in the game that I run, there's the ancient, you know, Proto-Egyptian Empire, where the grand highway, the buildings that are closer to the grand highway are always lower because the god kings have decreed that you have to be able to see them when they're walking through the highway.
Right.
Nice. So the closer you are to the road, the lower the building is going to be until you eventually have this sort of amphitheater seating as the buildings get taller and taller.
Yeah, makes sense.
This is also the rule around the Space Needle, too. This is why you can see the Space Needle, the building height restriction.
Washington monuments the same way. No building in D.C. is supposed to be taller than it is.
Yeah.
Wow. That blows my mind.
Monuments are a lot shorter than the Space Needle.
But yeah, like there's, I'm trying to remember which film this was, Baji Ramastani, there's a set partly in like a Brahmin kingdom in like southern India where the throne room instead of having like, you know, what we think of it in like kind of Western European style throne room, there's a raised dais. And there's a reflecting pool down the center of this like main hall with all the courtiers are like seated next to the hall kind of, and That is kind of the courtly setting, is instead of all this, you know, everybody in bristling armor and their weapons and like all their finery, it's like everybody in like very like in everyone in white clothing, everybody like seated calmly, and everything has to be, even when you're intriguing, you're doing it in the most calm possible manner, because you're, you know, otherwise you're being offensive and disrespectful. But all the backstabbing and stuff is still going on in the background of the movie. And then, you know, it's just that all the murdering is happening not in there.
Yeah, it's interesting. Your point about religion made me think about the ways in which the architectural innovations in the medieval period were incorporated into religious faith. So we invent the cathedral, and we invent the flying buttress, and we invent all things. And those things are fantastic architectural marvels in and of themselves. But they became indelibly associated with the churches that they were used to construct, right?
Rain gutters.
Everything becomes a part of your religion structure, because that's how we live our lives. That's what we base our things around. And so I think you're on a good point there, which is, think about when we're doing our settings, how was that setting shaped by faith? And what can that tell the players and the readers about those faiths? And maybe this is one of those half a sentence things where you're just sort of dropping in a holy symbol or something, or a favorite color, or a, you know, favorite animal or whatever. Or maybe it's something more important where this science or this kind of art or something was totally turned and completely directed towards the faith to show how important the faith was in that life, right? Yeah, I think it's a neat possibility.
One of the things that I remember from like the Dave Gross novels that they had was actually just religious gestures, so, or either pious or impious gestures, and it sticks in your mind, where like, oh, the spiral of Phrasma is like something like a pious gesture that is like tells you about like what the setting is and like what people believe in, versus the Tynes with their, you know, the chelish version of flipping someone the bird is you are giving them the pitchfork instead.
These are great things because you can do them at the table. Like,
yeah, true.
But they, you know, like it's a tiny little thing that as people are doing it, it's like reinforcing, kind of giving you clues about what they know and what they believe in.
Yeah. Yeah. Background. I don't know if this will be practical or useful, but I think just travel will help you a lot, right? Like just go to a non-European culture, like we largely have here, and just notice how the little things really throw you off, and why are they that way?
Yeah.
It's just great fodder for, you know, you don't do the same thing, but it's like, oh my God, I never thought that little difference would make such a difference in the field.
Yeah.
If you actually, you might not even have to travel very far if you live in a cosmopolitan enough area.
Yeah, go to the country, right?
I used to live,
get out of your element.
I used to live 10 minutes away from Little Cobble in Fremont, California, and just the immersion of Afghani culture was just everywhere.
Yeah, go to an Indian cinema instead of your regular normal cinema in the Bay Area. First time I did that,
here.
I was like, wow, this is a whole different game.
We're really lucky where we are, because we can drive 10 minutes and be at some fantastic scenery, right? And you should steal all of that stuff, right? Like, there's no reason not to steal all
of it. One of the things that I really like in adventures is like feasts and food, and just to see, like,
we're all foodies.
The Super Sizers Go TV series, which is on BBC and YouTube and all over the place, it's a food critic and a historian, or no, food critic and a comedian eating period foods of different periods of British history for a week at a time, and then they're like, oh, let's tell you about how this is killing you because you haven't had water now in a week. Like, the least alcoholic thing you've had to drink in a week is your small beer you have for breakfast, and then it's just wine and port and, you know, or like, oh, here's your stargazy pie with the fish head sticking out.
That showed up in my game once, as a player, not as a GM.
Like, here's a decorative pie that actually has live birds inside. Surprise! You know, like, man, food, like, can be so weird, and really actually was in many parts of history.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Like, speaking of, like, religious details and such, cursing. Mm. Because it's not all, you know, it's like how a lot of historically Catholic countries are much more into religious profanity than the English language is. Right. You know, not just telling damnation, but, you know, you could call someone, you know, son of a sacrament in its fighting words.
Right, you could swear by God's wounds or God's nails and so on, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, so what sorts of things do people swear by and at?
I know I've read some good ones. They're just not thinking, or I'm just not thinking of them right now. But I definitely have read some of our adventures that do, like...
Someone once told me, always make a slang dictionary for your campaign.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah.
It can be, it's really hard to implement. Like, you got to have player buy-in to make that work, you know? Maybe I'm the outlier here, but trying to use, like, swear words and things like that, I often feel like it feels really forced.
It's too much fracking work.
You know, frack is actually exactly where I was going, because the beauty of frack, it's like fork if you watch Good Place, right? Yeah. Like, everybody knows what word you mean.
Yep.
That's the way to do profanity in games, in my opinion, is to make up just an imaginary word that sounds so close to the word that you know everyone's going to recognize and just go with that.
Or things and... close enough of an analogy. Right?
Yeah.
Like, you know, if you would go, Jesus Christ.
Right.
It's like Saren Ray, anything in
yeah.
that same tone.
Yes.
It's the exact same point.
You're so right, because you it's know? The tone that's everything, right?
Yeah.
And it's hard to convey that in written language.
Yeah. Yeah. So like the Firefly approach doesn't work well in print. Right, you can't just suddenly start saying something that changes people know
you're yeah. yeah, Goram this, Goram
yeah.
that, right?
And if you've seen the Firefly RPG, they have pages of Chinese slang in the back of the rule book. Which, of course, if you're a big Firefly fan, you learn.
Right.
But it's a bit of an obstacle for new players.
But if you, I guess kind of the other side was talking about someone was mentioning the Blessing of G4-2, but that can also be fun and weird, and especially like in more like a, I think in the like Starfinder, it's sometimes
yes.
a little, we have kind of more weird cultures that you
yes.
are dealing with more peacefully and therefore can't just kill everybody on sight. Where as a total huge key important spoiler in a Starfinder adventure, there's some god that has the priestly blessing, I vomit into your mouth. Because that's a totally normal, like, a kind and wonderful, generous thing for
they're
you know,
bug
people of that
think.
Species
yeah.
to do.
Breath from my lungs.
Yeah,
exactly.
Doesn't go over maybe necessarily well in other cultures, but you're like, oh.
I feel like there's almost too much space for that in Starfinders. You've got all these different cultures that you expect to get fleshed out as a normal culture we're familiar with.
So the trick to that is, well, the beauty of Starfinder, what helping me understand and run Starfinder was when I heard Joe Pacini describe it as the cantina scene.
Exactly.
Right? You don't have to know everything about every alien in the cantina scene. You just got to have the one crazy thing, right? Like, this is the guy that, you know, these are the aliens that drink everything through a straw. That's all you know about them, but it's enough to get you through the cantina scene, right? And then when the players start investigating it, and we're back to the one cool thing again, they start investigating it, and now you got to spend 3 hours developing the culture that drinks everything through a straw.
Spoilers,
but if your players don't care, you just keep going. What's that?
And spoilers, those things you thought were bubble tea were coming
right,
up that
right,
straw.
Right. So just my only observation there was is don't feel like you have to detail everything, because you don't. You can just...
Well, that was a real problem when I started Starfinder Rise. I wanted to have a rich pantheon of gods for everyone of these races, and that quickly became impossible.
Yeah, but...
80th playable race.
And you can see, though, what the developers did for that exact, right? They thought, well, instead, let's have a pantheon of 20 gods, I think, that basically every culture worships, right? And they did that on purpose to solve that problem.
See,
at your table, though, you don't have to do it that way. You can do whatever you want.
So for more personal settings, like someone's room or house or whatever,
oh, yeah, sure.
How do you develop that to make it more personal other than just, oh, it's a bit messy, or, oh, it's neat, I guess?
Think about like what would be one or two meaningful things for that
yeah.
person to have, whether it's like a picture of something they love or like some really weird like kind of tchotchke thing that they got as a gift, or that was passed down through their family, that you know is maybe a clue of what was going on.
Or their duvet covered in cat hair.
So I'm going to use a specific example, okay? And this is a bit of a spoiler, because I don't think Assault on the Crucible is out yet. right? But this is like Starfinder 18. I think it comes out next month, I think. But at one point, there's these hags. So there's like three hags in the adventure. Spoiler. So I had to think up some way to create their rooms in the place. And I had like basically one sentence for each one. They don't have full descriptive NPC write-ups. I didn't have room for all of them. It's basically one encounter. But I wanted to make them all different, right? So, like, what I tried to do was follow Judy's idea, which is basically one cool thing in every room. So, like, one of them's got... I did, like, a maiden, hag, mother kind of trope for the three hags, right? So, like, one of them's got, like, a poppet on the bed that's, you know, made up of... I forget how I did it. And then the second one's got, like, this chair that she stole from a steward... starship that she blew up, right? So she's got like the captain's chair in her room, right? And then the third one is the old hag, and she's got like this whole wall of like broken TV screens that she uses to see the future, right? So you just kind of invent like one cool thing, and it doesn't really make a lot of sense when the players first see it, but after they meet the character, they're like, oh, she's the young one, she had the poppet. Like, they kind
see,
of put
Jason
it together.
Makes it sound so easy, though, because he's a skilled writer. Like, I will say that, so you're talking about, though, to break it down, you're talking about evoking a sense of awe in the captain's chair and shock, right? Like, I blew up your ship, and I got your chair, and I sit in it every day. And so now it's a setting piece.
My chair.
Its own.
Yeah.
And it's yes. And these broken screens that other people would disregard. So what are now this very vital everyday thing I need magically to see, you know, and scry. And so kind of to that point is take the normal thing, think about the feeling that you want it to evoke, and then try to turn that on its head once or twice, and you'll probably get somewhere close to that.
Very
and then
kind.
You know.
I want to be on his panel all the time.
You're kind of a really great place of fodder for this. You mentioned Donald Garman, and I think just the entire design thinking crowd that goes back and figures out how to design things to really solve a problem really well, their thought process is really great for just coming up with weird shit that does the same thing that's not what you expect. So that's a really rich area to study.
Okay. Yeah. And kind of on that note, we are out of time.
So much fun. Thank you so much. Thank you, everyone.
Hope you all got some fun. I can finally clean up Blake Placid here.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction PaizoCon 2019 seminar coverage. We'd like to thank Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad and Justin Sluder of Justin Sluder for the recorders they provided, as well as the KD Con team for their diligent work. To find this and other great convention coverage, visit NoDirectionPodcast.com.